Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my very special guest is Shenandoah Sheffalo. She's author of Garbage Bag Suitcase, a memoir. Shenandoah's dreams for a stable childhood were shattered. The money she earned working at the local grocery store was taken by her foster parents to, quote, cover their expenses. When she was in the hospital for 3 weeks due to serious injuries from a car accident, no one came to visit her. She realized she was more alone than ever before. Despite her heartbreaking circumstances, Shenandoah overcame adversities and became part of the 3% of all foster care children who go to college and the 1% who graduate. Despite becoming a successful businesswoman and having a daughter of her own, she still suffers the long-term effects of her neglected childhood. In Garbage Bag Suitcase, she shares her story in hope of spurring immediate change that needs to take place within the system and what we all can do to help these children. Shenandoah is a graduate of Michigan State University, holding a Bachelor of Arts with a major in Interdisciplinary Studies in Social Science, a Core Essentials graduate from Coach U, a certified Law of Attraction Advanced Practitioner, and a member of the Foster Leaders Movement. She is a sought-after speaker on topics surrounding youth and foster care. For more information, you can visit her website, which is www.garbagebagsuitcase.com. And I do have a direct link to her website in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome Shen to the show. Good day. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Robert.
Well, it is my pleasure, and this is one topic that in the 5 years of doing my radio show, I have not or have yet to address. So I'm very happy that you were able to get to me and that we are able to talk about this important topic today.
And as it turns out, May happens to be National Foster Care Awareness Month, so you have perfect timing.
What a coincidence. I just love that. I love that. No, it is great. You know, and even though, you know, May was for that kind of raising awareness, that's something that we really need to do, throughout the year. But, I'd like to start with, first of all, why did you, let me start with this. You know, I've had many people on the show who have written memoirs and have talked about challenging experiences and how they've overcome them. Now, mm-hmm. I am in complete admiration for someone who does that because it's, you put yourself out there and it's you open yourself up to all kinds of reactions, you know, good and critical, you know. I mean, there's always the critical, you know, but so
always.
What, so why, what led you to the point of realizing that this was something that you wanted to do, to put this into writing and get it out there?
Well, I often say that I'm an accidental writer, which is I never had an inclination to be a writer or an author. It was not on the bucket list, if you will. but what happened was, I'd spent 20 years in law office management, and I really had kind of become burnt out of the cycle. I worked primarily in criminal defense offices and lots of hours, high stress, high demand clients. And I just noticed the theme of kind of the same person coming through the office. And I just really was burnt out and didn't see any way in which I could make a difference. And so I spent some time thinking and actually ended up going back to school for coaching. And in that process, when I was building my coaching business, I met a gentleman who was, of all things, helping me write part of the text for my website because I was struggling writing the About Me section, my biography section, which is ironic now. But at the time, I was really struggling, and so he sat down basically to write, you know, to interview me so he could help me write this section. And the meeting was supposed to be about a half hour long, and 3 hours later in our conversation, he said, listen, I'll write this for you, but have you ever thought about writing a book? And I really laughed at him and thought, oh, you're so funny. And so he really kind of persisted on this issue and insisted that you really need to consider writing. You should really write. And so I got sick of his emails and phone calls and finally sat down and said, I'll write you something so you'll stop calling me. And I sat down and 30 pages came out, which was not my intent. And then I sent those off to him, hoping to never hear from him again, frankly. And 24 hours later, he called me back and said, I need 30 more pages. And so that kind of started the process. And once I was started on the process, the idea of how this book would end was nagging at me. And I was wondering, you know, my life isn't even half over yet in my own mind, right? So what am I going to do? And so I started doing research, and that's when I really came to understand the impact of kind of adverse childhood experiences and dysfunctional families and what happens to kids. I kind of understood myself in a new way, and I started to see the world in a whole new way. And that was the moment where I knew that the book really wasn't about me at all. The book was about how we could change the system.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting how that unfolded. I mean, you know, it seems that you were really put in touch with the right person, with the right interest to create that motivation, you know, and you know, baby steps that you were kind of given, you know, to actually get to the point of recognizing the bigger picture of what that was all about.
Exactly. And you know, I think that happens to us all the time. And sometimes we listen and sometimes we don't, right? So that's this whole idea of understanding what we're, the plane we're vibrating on, what we're attracting to ourselves, and then are we willing to do the next part, which is take action?
Yeah, very much so. Well,
which is for me a crucial piece.
Well, it is for everybody. I mean, I can't tell you how many people I've come across that said that, you know, they wanted to write a book, you know, and it's like, okay, well, what have you written? Well, nothing. It's like, okay, you know, or, you know, there are people who, I mean, I know several right off the top of my head who have had a book, you know, pretty, they could easily be published anytime, but haven't, you know what I mean? And it's like, and I sit back and I know, knowing these people, I know that's a fear factor, you know, of putting it out there and, you know, recognizing that there's going to be criticism. I mean, you know, and there will be, you know, accolades as well, but, you know, it's that fear of criticism, which, you know, I've learned to just, you know, ignore that, you know.
Yeah, I have too. And so, because that comes to my other thing, which is for me, I think one of the things that kind of really helped me in my own process of healing was this learning how to ask, which is a real skill, actually. And a lot of people are afraid of the ask. But I finally realized that if I never asked for anything, the answer was always no. And that when I finally decided to ask for something, then that opened me up to the possibility of a yes. Not that I would always get a yes, but it opened me up to the possibility of a yes. And that's, once I started viewing it that way, the fear was no longer there.
Yeah, great. Well, now, would you explain to the listeners why it is that you chose the title Garbage Bag Suitcase?
Yeah, it was a natural fit for me, but prior to foster care, I had gone to, so through kindergarten through seventh grade, I had been to 35 schools across the country, schools that sometimes I went to for a day, a week, a month. At one point, I used to joke with my stepbrother that, you know, oh, hey, we have this record of going to a school for one day. And then an instance happened where my mom registered me for school, and then we actually moved before I could even show up for the first day of school. So
wow.
35 schools in that kind of transition. And then once in foster care, it is kind of a well-known thing that most foster children kind of show up with this garbage bag full of their belongings, and that as they move from home to home within the system, it is kind of the symbolic thing of this garbage bag that follows them around. And then there's the kind of more metaphysical and how you feel about yourself and the way you see yourself is just everything belongs in this garbage bag. So it's kind of a double meaning for me, how I view myself, but it's also about kind of my nomadic journey through life.
Yeah, well, it does fit, you know, it does fit. And, you know, that's the one thing I think that, you know, hopefully the listeners will gather from our discussion today is you know, a perspective from a foster child's point of view and some of the challenges. And then, as I mentioned in the introduction, you know, some of those beliefs, mistaken beliefs, really can carry through to adulthood. You know, it can create challenges, you know, once the child grows up. What do you? I'd like to talk about some of the you know, challenges and some of the things, you know, regarding the system, both from a challenges for the children, as well as also for foster parents too, because I mean it's, you know, it's a obviously a relationship that has challenges on both sides, in both with the relationship and then also with the system. So what I'd like to start with, the, you know, I guess overall, what is the biggest challenge first of all regarding the foster care system? Let's start with that system first.
I mean, I think the easiest thing to kind of point out for everyone on all sides of this is how we deal with trauma. Every child who comes to the foster care system has been through some type of trauma. That's what's led them there. You know, a parent who is incarcerated, a parent who has caused some sort of physical or emotional abuse or neglect, you know, a parent who's mentally ill, a parent who has a substance abuse problem, all of these things and many more. Some trauma at the base of it has happened to cause a child to be in foster care. And I think the thing that we overlook the most is not addressing that trauma. And so you have essentially a child who is grieving for some reason. You know, depending on the age of the child, they don't always understand why they're even in the system or what's going on. And I think we oftentimes overlook the grief factor of a foster child. And I think by overlooking that, a child's not allowed to grieve or they don't properly grieve. And I think that can come out in behaviors that look different for different people. That can come out as anger for some people. That can come out as sadness or depression and withdrawn behaviors for others, because we all deal with grief differently. And so I think then we forget that a child's grieving, and then we try to treat behaviors in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
So that when an incident happens in the foster home or at the school, we're then just looking at that behavior as a standalone thing versus understanding that maybe it's a symptom of something else that's going on. So for me,
right,
in general terms, that is the biggest mistake that's happening both from a foster care system and from, you know, both parents and kids, because I don't think kids understand what's going on, and I don't think that they have the tools to properly express what's going on within themselves or to even know what's going on within themselves. And then that gets complicated by a system that's a government-run system that's full of paperwork and, you know, processes and procedures that don't always make logical sense on the outside looking in. And so the child kind of gets lost in that. And then I think that's how, you know, resentment and anger builds, because, you know, we kind of reinforce the negative behaviors. That's when you get the time and attention of other people, is when you act out negatively.
Well, you know, the idea of treating, you know, behaviors instead of causes. I mean, you know, that in our medical system, it's treating symptoms versus the cause. I mean, it seems to be you know, a typical type of approach to problem solving, even though, you know, it's obviously not the most effective. Now, I believe that there's a trend toward trauma-informed care. So can you talk about that, what that is?
Yeah, and this is based off of a study that was kind of done in the late 1990s, actually, by an obesity clinic in California in cooperation with the CDC. And they started realizing that their obesity patients weren't losing weight, but what they all had in common was that they had experienced an adverse childhood experience. And if you Google that term, adverse childhood experiences, you'll get more information than you could read in a lifetime. But what it kind of boils down to are these 10 things that happen to children before they're 18 that we can use as a predictor, not only for their mental health and things like depression and substance abuse, but they also are connected to actual physical body ailments, from everything from vision to cancer, heart risk, life expectancy rates. There's a lot of things physically that we can determine from these kind of traumatic stressors that occur in someone's life before 18. And so now what we can do is we can kind of quiz somebody about these adverse childhood experiences, and we can make some predictions that we might not have otherwise been able to make. And it can garner how then we can encourage resiliency to try to heal that trauma and try to protect them from these things in the future, which is ultimately what's happening. So trauma-informed is really saying, okay, we know that if these things happen to you, these other physical things might happen to you, or that it might increase your risk for substance abuse or depression or suicide or all of these other impacts that we haven't always related. And once we know that, then, and we can treat a person from a different standpoint, once we know. So instead of asking the age-old question, hey, what's wrong with that person? You know, and we've all asked ourselves that. We've seen somebody maybe acting out in a grocery store or who's cut us off in traffic, right? And instead of saying, gosh, what's wrong with that person? If we say, what's happened to that person? We kind of have a whole new discussion about what's going on and tying what we're seeing, their actions that are happening currently in front of us, to digging maybe a little bit deeper onto why they would be having those actions.
Yeah, well, that's proactive. I mean, it seems to be a very proactive approach, you know, to providing guidance. You know, where in the past it seems like that may have, you know, just been viewed as just a typical outcome. You know, a typical progression from, you know, early experience.
Exactly. So sometimes, right, you know, Johnny pushes somebody in school and then kind of a certain set of things happen. He gets sent down to the principal's office and then a decision's made. Maybe he has detention or he's suspended or something like that. But if Johnny pushes a child and then he goes to the principal's office and they have a conversation and the principal says, well, Johnny, what's going on? Right. And then Johnny tells a story of how mom was arrested last night. And he hasn't been to bed or whatever. Not that it's an excuse for the behavior and he doesn't need to be held accountable for pushing the other student. He does. But I think that then the principal and everyone else around has a little bit more information on exactly what we want to do with Johnny going forward.
Yeah.
So Johnny might
still
get the detention, but we might also realize, hey, there's more going on in Johnny's life than the fact that he's just being mean for the sake of being mean.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
which
exactly.
Which is kind of what we do now is, well, that person's just a jerk, or, you know, they're just a mean person. But sometimes there's a lot more going on. Or if you just see someone who's sad all the time, oh, they're just always sad, you know. Nothing ever makes them happy. But if you kind of dig a little deeper, suddenly you can see it from a whole new empathetic way.
Yeah, exactly. Now, excuse me, what would you say would be the biggest misconception about the foster care system?
Well, there's lots of misconceptions. Probably one of the biggest is that kids in foster care are delinquents. It's one that I still hear quite often, which is, well, what did you do to get in foster care? As if I have done something or other children have done something. So one of the biggest misconceptions is that kids are in foster care because of their own behavior. Kids are in foster care because they have no parents or that their parents have done something to not be able to take care of them. So I think that's one of the big misconceptions that just a lot of people are still carrying around with them.
Yeah. You know, I'd like to talk a little bit about first of all, I do want to let listeners know that at the bottom of the hour, we're going to take a quick break. And if you have any questions for Shen, feel free to call in. The number is 619-789-4359. And we'll get to them right after the break. But okay, I'd like to kind of talk a little bit about, you know, the challenges for children in foster care. And I went online and did a little, you know, just a quick little research, and some of the things that they came up with is first of all is the idea of some kind of physical or sexual abuse that sometimes happens when they're in that system. Is that something that that occurs often, or is it you know just because it seems people have heard stories. I mean, I've heard, you know, heard stories like that, and I'm not, you know, and you would hope that it is like the extreme rare exception, but is it?
I wish I could say that it was, Robert. I really do.
Okay.
It happens, and I think it happens more frequently than people would be comfortable knowing about. I after writing this book, I end up being the person that a lot of people send emails to that contain, did you see this story? Have you heard about this? What can, you know, from all over the country. And there are kids being abused and abused and abused, you know, not only in their own homes, but in foster homes. And it's a sad reality of what's happening.
Yeah, yeah.
It is definitely happening.
Yeah,
it is not happening everywhere. There are, of course, great foster families that exist and operate, and you have great places, and then you have places that aren't so great. And I think it's, you know, we have to talk about it if we're going to heal it and help correct it. And it's uncomfortable, and I think it's hard to talk about, but we have to talk about it.
Yeah, you know, that's the one thing, you know, I read actually in one of the reviews that you had on the book, someone had indicated that for them it was an uncomfortable read, you know, in reading your book, you know, but recognize the importance of that. And, you know, it's the fact that it's uncomfortable, I think is really important, because then that, to me, that just indicates there's an innate knowing that something is wrong, you know, and that something needs to be fixed.
Yeah. You know, I have people who say, oh, I've bought your book. It's been sitting on my nightstand or on my dresser for the last month or so, and I've just been looking at it, but I can't convince myself to read it because I don't want to be sad. And really, the point of the book is not to make you sad. The point of the book is really to have an open and honest conversation. And I say this, you know, that there are children in foster care who survived much worse than I did. And I hear from them all the time. And one of the reasons I chose to hear my story is that I thought it was a gentler story that would engage people into listening further. You know, sometimes if something is really traumatic, it can turn people off and then they don't want to listen anymore. And one of the reasons I felt compelled to write and share my story is because the story was so much bigger than the things that happened to me. But what are we going to do about it? So, yes, I share my story because I want you to see what it's like in the life of a foster kid. But I end my story talking about kind of these long-term effects and how I'm dealing with them and how it's made me the person I am today. And then next, which is, what are we going to do to fix it? And there's stuff everyone can do that costs no money, no time, you know, very little effort on your part to make small changes. And that's what's important for me is I've shared my story, but are you done and bored with the story? Like, oh, that was entertainment for a few hours. Or did it affect you enough that you're willing to listen and get educated more and take action and do something to change potentially a child's life?
Yeah, that's great. You know, and I understand the walking that fine line of telling the story to be engaging enough to hold the interest, but not to the point of, you know, like you say, turning someone off. And then, you know, in that call to action, I mean, to me, you know, raising awareness is the first step. You know, then the natural progression is taking action, is doing something to make it different. And in the second half of the show, I want to talk a little bit about what people can do, you know, for that, as well as, you know, maybe some system changes that we can do. But before that, one of the challenges that were indicated was neglect. And it's interesting that I always love how life kind of shows me things right before shows. Last night, I was watching a show called The Family. I think it's on ABC or one of those major stations. But anyway, it's called The Family. And in the show, one of the main characters is a kid who was supposedly kidnapped and comes back to a family. But they trace it back to a foster home situation. And the detective goes into the situation, and the foster parent is feeding one kid, and she kind of wants answers, and he doesn't want to do it, and she mentions the laws, and you know, the limit is like 4, and he's got like 8 cups, so, and it was like, you know, that provides a great income, you know, so, and I just kind of, when I saw that, I was like, oh man, you know, this, here we are talking about the foster care system, and some of the, you know, the, I guess, abuses, you know, and the idea that, you know, some parents choose to be foster care parents primarily for the financial support that the child receives from the government. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, that kind of situation or reality?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, whenever money is involved with people, it's a sensitive topic. And I think that it's no more evident than in the foster care system. So, you know, there are definitely altruistic foster parents that I know and love who take children in. And yes, they receive some money from the government and they spend way more than they ever receive. And they go above and beyond and treat the children like their own. There are other foster parents, and very much like my own experience, where they will spend as least as possible so that that money can go into the family income, so to speak, and for their own household expenses. And so things that maybe were allotted for school clothing, you know, you might not actually get school clothing. You might just go with what you already have, and then they're using that money for their own gain. And so in my own experience, everything that I needed, I provided myself. So I started working at 14, little jobs, bagging groceries, right, and then doing other things as I got older. Because all of that was, if I wanted to play volleyball at school, I had to pay for that. If I needed new underwear, I needed to pay for that myself. And so I think it's difficult, and I think especially as you get older in the foster care system and eventually age out, as I did, it can become very clear that you're just kind of tied to this paycheck. And I think it can build a resentment in you that nobody in the world cares, you know, that this is, you know, if you're a kid and you don't really understand the money factor, a small child, you know, you think people are just, because you're made to feel like you should feel grateful that anybody's helping you.
Yeah.
You know, that was a big feeling as I was a kid, is that the foster parents were kind of touted as these heroes of the community. And then you were just supposed to feel grateful that anyone was willing to even take you in. And then you kind of learn this money game, and it can be a do some real detriment to your self-worth and how you view yourself as a person.
Yeah, I could see where, you know, where that would be the case. And, when you grow up, when the child grows up, then, yeah, it really does feed into, you know, the whole sense of value that one has. Now, one of the other challenges before we go to break was homelessness. Now, you know, you talked about the fact that, you know, the garbage bag aspect of kind of going from home to home. And in your particular case, you had cases where you had to, in a matter of minutes, get kind of shift homes. So how does that homelessness, you know, contribute to the psyche of the child?
Well, you feel like you never belong. And the best example I can give is, even after I became a professional and I would be at cocktail parties or networking events or weddings or funerals or wherever, and you would meet somebody and they would say, "Where are you from?" That question still today gives me this kind of sinking sensation and feeling, because how do I answer that question as a person who has lived in so many places, who really doesn't want to get into the story about why she's lived in 50 places and no, I was not a military brat. You know, like, it's little things about this sense of belonging where you feel like you belong nowhere. So when people talk about their childhoods or growing up in a specific neighborhood or how they still have their same best friend from kindergarten, or, hey, do you remember that teacher? She was so great in second grade, and you can't even remember all the places you lived in second grade. So it turns into this kind of what's wrong with me and how come I don't fit in anywhere.
Wow. You know, I never really thought about, you know, that, you know, something as simple a question of where are you from that could create such discomfort in someone. I mean, I'm sure people generally don't think about that as being a, you know, like something that would make you uncomfortable. Yeah, you know, it's kind of like,
because it's,
you know,
just a common, you know, question. It's like, how's the weather, right? It's
just exactly.
We ask each other without putting much thought behind. And that's the thing. It's just this displacement that I realized I would get all this anxiety when I had to go to this stuff. And I thought, gosh, I wouldn't really consider myself introverted. You know, I enjoy people, but what I don't enjoy is meeting people. You know, it took me a long time to kind of get through that process, that I always enjoyed being around people, that I like people, but meeting new people was where I would get my anxiety from. And so when you start to learn kind of what your triggers are, then it can get better and you can think of clever things to say, you know, when people ask you these questions.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I mean, you know, when asked that question now, what is your response, you know, to people?
Well, now it's much easier because a lot of people have read the book. So
less people ask it.
But, you know, I can now say, well, I was born in San Diego, and I was raised across the country, and I can have kind of this better, I was born here, but, you know.
There you go.
I can have a more interesting question. but it was tricky for a lot of years for me.
Yeah,
that and, you know, my name usually strikes you know, as soon as somebody introduces me as Shenandoah, there's usually, okay, I need to know about this, right? That's not a name that most people have. I need to hear more about this. And it's actually one of the stories I share in the book, which is my biological mother and my stepfather, who at the time I thought was my biological father, would tell me all the time that I was named after this hotel in Las Vegas. And then when I started doing, this is a story that I believed forever. And so I used to joke with people, well, at least it wasn't the Tropicana, because that would have been a terrible name, right? So I kind of turned it into a joke. But when I started researching for this book and I was putting this story in there, I was researching about the Shenandoah Hotel to learn more. And then I realized that, too, was a lie. The hotel was actually built 5 years after I was born, so I couldn't have been named after the hotel, right? So it's how you piece all of who you think you are with all of who the people around you have told you you are.
Wow, boy. It seems like you have to be a detective in order to find out about your life.
But isn't it funny, because even someone who's maybe growing up with their two parents, right, in a mm-hmm. traditional setting, what have our parents told us that we've just accepted that maybe isn't necessarily true for us? I mean,
yeah.
For me, that's
yeah.
kind of this bigger question of the meaning of life, right?
Yeah, exactly. And on that note, why don't we go ahead and take a quick break here. We're going to take about a 90-second break. Again, if anyone listening would like to call in, the number is 619-789-4359. And then when we return, Shen, I want to go ahead and talk about the challenges from the parent side, and in particular the system, okay?
Okay.
Everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this very brief break. Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope that you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link to the approximately 1,000 shows that we have had over the past 5 years. Our show is available as a free podcast in the iTunes Store. You can subscribe there, or even quicker, there is a link to our show on iTunes on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Pinterest, etc., and we have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. And finally, also on the site is a link to the great products we provide: books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store with essential oils and personal and spa products. There is so much for you to explore and enjoy on our website, www.biteradio.me. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show. Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. Again, today my very special guest is Shenandoah Cheffalo, and we are talking about her book, Garbage Bag Suitcase, and also the foster care system. And again, you can find out more by visiting her website, which is www.garbagebagsuitcase.com. And again, there is a direct link to her webpage in the show page description. And on her webpage, you can find information about her book, events, news, and blog. And, of course, if you want to contact Shen, there is contact information available as well. So with that, we're back. Thanks for staying with me, Jen. Shen.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, now I want to talk a little bit about the challenges from the parent side. Now, one of the things we talked about, you know, is the idea of you know, working with behaviors, you know, that often parents, you know, kind of, and it's typical to deal with, you know, behaviors that a foster child would exhibit, problem behaviors maybe that are exhibited. So for foster parents who maybe do not know the trauma that the child experienced. Is the whole trauma-informed approach really the where they should start to be able to identify maybe why what the source of the behaviors are?
I think so, because it's not so much knowing maybe what the trauma is, it's just knowing that the trauma exists. And then once you know that there's been a trauma, which I think is a fair assumption once they show up in your foster home, that there's been a trauma, is then how you interact with that child on a day-to-day basis. I would say, you know, I can only talk about my own experience, and I think mm-hmm. one of the kind of pitfalls we fall into is that we try to generalize. Well, if this worked for this kid, mm-hmm. it'll work for every kid, which is probably one of the major mistakes we make, right, is because when you're dealing with humans, the one thing you can expect is the unexpected. So
right.
Just when you think you have it figured out, someone will show you that you don't. So we have to treat each person as their own unique individual snowflake, and that if you have multiple kids in your home or you have one kid who leaves and another kid who comes, that the same things might not work. And that sometimes it's a matter of building trust and respect. You know, I just assumed that I would be moving foster homes. So why would I listen or do anything that these people said? And so it's learning how to trust somebody again. You know, I had to relearn trust. I felt as a child that I could never trust anyone. And even after I aged out of the foster care system at 18, I just felt that the world was full of untrustworthy people. And it took me a long time and a lot of painful mistakes to realize there are some people that can be trusted. But that wasn't an easy lesson, and that took a lot of time and patience.
Yeah.
And I think we live in a society where we want everything to be instantaneous. And I think with people's emotions and their griefs, it's not. You have to stick with it, and sometimes it takes a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a real tough one, especially if, you know, a child, you know, has the experience. I mean, it's, you know, as you, you know, I would think for a young child to have the experiences, teenagers would probably be more aware, you know, of,
mm-hmm.
of, you know, trust, who's trustworthy, who's not, or, you know, some are, some aren't, that kind of thing. But certainly when you have a young child who's really in the process of forming their belief systems, you know, that could be really, you know,
Regardless of your age, you realize that you can't trust your parents.
Yeah.
I mean, that trauma in and of itself, the realization that the people who are supposed to take care of you the most are the ones you can trust the least. When that happens to you, I think it's really hard to trust anyone.
Yeah. Oh,
including
yourself.
I can
see that. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and then you question why, you know, what is it with, you know,
yeah.
what's the reason for that? Yeah. Hmm. Now,
what could I do differently?
Yeah, exactly. And quite often kids do that. I mean, even, you know, not in foster care situations. I mean, you know, whenever, you know, there's parents go through divorce, quite often it's like, you know, what did I do? Am I the one? You know, so, I mean.
I think people are surprised. I say this often, and people say, gosh, I'm surprised you weren't more angry with your mother in the book. And here's the thing. As I sit here and talk to you today, I'm not angry with my mom. I always felt like I had let my mom down because, you know, I self-reported myself to foster care. And I really felt like my mom needed me, and I let her down. I said, you know, there was kind of a lifeboat floating by that one person could fit in, and I took it for myself. And so I think a lot of kids feel that way, that they somehow let their parents down or that they did something that contributed to this. And so that's a tough thing to get over.
Yeah, it would be. Now, what, I have a question regarding the process of selecting parents to be foster parents, you know. So are there particular guidelines, like are they national, state, city, are there guidelines
they're
requirements?
By state. Yeah, there's
okay.
state guidelines. So every state has their own guidelines for who can or cannot be a foster parent. And then with that, the kind of training and licensing process is different from state to state as well, which then, of course, makes all these different inconsistencies between states. The one thing I want to say about this topic is A, I wish there was more training for foster parents. The training in Michigan, in my mind, I've actually been through it. My husband and I were licensed foster parents for a very, very short period of time. I wish that it was more and more intense, but what I wish even more is that there was a system to do a better job of matching kids with foster parents and parents with kids. Mm. The thing is, you know, every time I watch TV and there is some online dating commercial, my that how much time and effort has been put into finding the perfect mate, but how little time and effort we put into putting a kid into a home. Really, oftentimes we just say, well, who has a bed available, and the kid goes there. But there's a lot more to it than that. And wouldn't it be nice if we could match kids to homes and spend the time that it would take to do that appropriately? And would we potentially have better outcomes if kids were matched better?
Yeah, I could see where, you know, matching, you know, having, I'm sure you would have, traits and dispositions and, you know, I'm sure there are probably a lot of different factors that can go into, you know, creating matches. And I could see where that would be the case. And that would be great. I was just curious because it seems that, you know, the whole process of, you know, someone becoming, being certified to be a foster parent. You know, that is like the first step toward ensuring that the child would go to, you know, a loving home. You know, even though I'm sure there are always challenges. I mean, anytime you have parent child, whether it be parent, you know, biological child, parent stepchild, or foster child, you know, there are always going to be those kind of challenges. But to minimize the challenges, it seems that setting up guidelines and training would be the first step to ensure a better compatibility.
Yeah, and I'm not sure about every state. Again, I can speak to Michigan because that's where I am currently. But there's also no continuing education requirement, which is always a little bit bothersome to me. There's volunteer stuff that most agencies will put on. Oh, we have a volunteer thing. But, you know, almost anybody who is employed in any sort of profession has some sort of continuing education that they have to do on a yearly basis. And so it is a little bit worrisome to me that I'm not seeing that in the foster care realm, because that's where you could get into deep diving into issues and to, you know, really understand things like attachment disorders and being trauma informed and kind of learning new skills that could really help you be more effective as a communicator, as a parent, as a person.
Yeah. Now, is the court system in the court, you know, foster care system, is it, unyielding? I mean, is it one that, is conducive to being able to, kind of like a speedy kind of match and enforcement? Or is it like a typical court system where that it's slow and methodical, cumbersome and quite often?
Yeah, I actually think it's probably the slowest part of the court system in general, because in a lot of abuse neglect dockets, you have cases that can drag on and linger for years. where people are coming in every 90 days for kind of these status and review hearings and, you know, and the kids being drugged back into court and everyone's coming and social workers and caseworkers and guardian ad litems and every, you know, and they can go on for years. My own case went on the entire time I was in foster care. So from 13 till 18, every 90 days, you're in that process and in that loop. Yeah. So
that's
for
crazy.
Me, it is a part of the system that goes on forever and never seems to end.
Yeah, and it seems it would just constantly be a reinforcement that you're in a system, that you're really, you know what I mean, that you're part of this clog, you know, this wheel that, you know, and that's just,
yeah,
it's kind of like you don't have your life of your own.
But I talked about how the court system added to my own trauma in that I'd have to go to court and that I'd be so anxiety-ridden that I'd have to see my biological mother. And what if she showed up and I had to talk to her and would I be able to tell her that I couldn't live with her anymore, right? That was one side of my brain thinking. And then there was the other side of my brain thinking, well, what if my mom doesn't show up? Why doesn't she care about me?
Yeah. Damned if you do and
right?
damned if you don't,
so
kind of thing.
Yeah. So, but every 90 days, right? So it was just this constant churning of feeling trapped and that no matter what you do, it won't be right. There is no right choice. And so that's part of just understanding this trauma and understanding that, gosh, you know, if a kid's that anxiety ridden about, you know, doing this court thing, that maybe their behaviors might reflect that. You know, that might look different. Again, that might be depression and withdrawal for one kid. That might be exuberance and something that resembles ADHD for another kid. For another kid, it might come out in anger and rage, right? So it could be different for everyone.
Yeah. Wow. My goodness. Well, we've got about 7 minutes left, and I want to cover maybe what are some things that the average person out there listening can do to help. What can someone do to make a contribution?
Well, this is a true story, Robert, and that is, everyone has the resources to be kinder to the person next to them. And so I just blogged about this recently, and so you can read the whole story on my blog. But I was standing in line at a grocery store, and a woman started screaming at the cashier. And the old me from 10 or 15 years ago would have thought, this woman's crazy, and I'm just going to mind my own business and not get involved. The new me is a little bit brasher than that. And so as I kind of snuck my way up to the front of my grocery cart, and this woman's yelling louder and louder at this poor cashier, who, of course, can't do anything about anything this woman's yelling about. And I just said, I'm sorry, excuse me, but it seems like you're having a really bad day. Is everything okay? And the woman immediately stopped yelling and just looked at me. And a couple seconds went by, and the cashier is ringing the rest of her stuff up. And then she just, and I said, everything will be okay. And she looked at me and said, my mother's in the intensive care unit, and I knew I shouldn't have come to this store because it always makes me angry. And I just said, I'm really sorry that she's sick. And so the cashier kind of finished ringing her up, and she was kind of hanging around there, and the cashier started ringing my stuff, and then she kind of made her way to the door there to leave. And when I came out, she just said, I just want to thank you so much. It's just that little thing that when someone's having a moment, sometimes they just need to know it's going to be okay. And that, you know, you never know when holding the door for someone or telling someone, gosh, your dress looks beautiful or your smile is beautiful, could really change somebody's life. And all of us are capable of it. It doesn't cost us anything, you know. And even if that wouldn't have been her response, even if her response is mind your own business, the bottom line is it got her to stop yelling. And that's all that needed to happen, right? Like, we weren't accomplishing anything with the yelling. So
right, yeah.
That's it just takes a moment to just be kind. And sometimes, you know, I share a story about my sixth grade teacher who told me once how very special I was. And he probably told all of his students over his 30-plus years of teaching how very special they were. And he probably never thought very much of it when he told me how very special I was. But what he didn't know was that when he said that to me, it was the first time somebody had said that to me. And at the time, I was getting ready to go into foster care. And so it was the last time for a long time that somebody said that to me. And it really changed and affected me, just that statement. And aren't we all capable of saying that to somebody who really might be hurting and we just don't know the effect that it has, and we have to be okay with that.
Yeah, exactly.
So we can
exactly.
all do
it doesn't
that.
Take much.
Yeah, all of your listeners, everyone is capable of just being nicer.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, every now and then, you know, if there's one of those doors that has where you can kind of step on the front to open automatic door thing. I see like an older person kind of walking up. I run up and I step on it. And go, let me get that for you. And they always laugh. They always laugh, you know. And it's, so you know, and that's you know, and it's just you know, to me, I just give a little chuckle because it's you know that you know throughout the day they're going to be you know laughing about that and like what you did with the cashier. You know, it meant a lot to the person who you spoke to. But I'm sure it also meant a lot to the cashier because you really diffused, you know, a situation and it probably, you know, she probably would have, you know, had that angry person in her thoughts for at least three or four people afterwards, you know what I mean, versus now
exactly.
when you intervened. Yeah, you changed the whole dynamic of that interaction.
And usually, I mean, I think we know that when we see a person who looks like they're acting irrationally, it has nothing to do with the situation at hand, right?
Yeah.
It's always about something deeper or has a bigger meaning somewhere else. And that was the thing. This was a woman who was sad and upset and probably a little angry that she was going to be losing her mother. And then, you know, something bad happened in the store, of course, because she's on this negative right vibration anyways, and the store doesn't have something she wants or needs, and then that just escalates, and then it comes out in this way that has nothing to do with why she's really upset in the first place, right? Because she's really in the end grieving, and it's how we want to act. Now, on the opposite side, everyone in line, myself, the people behind me, could have laughed and pointed at her and made her and belittle her and made her feel even worse about herself. But, you know, and it could have turned it that way. But if we just all turn it to a little bit more positivity, I think it's better for all of us.
Exactly. Well, we're down to the last couple of minutes. So before we close, is there anything that you would like to say to children who are or young adults who are currently in foster care?
I think the one thing that I always like to try to end on is the simple thing for kids, for me, for adults, for everybody, which is if we focus on solutions together, we can move forward into greatness.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, that's great. Well, Shen, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today. It's, you know, this is, again, a very important topic, you know, and one that we really need to have more discussion about. And again, kudos to you for writing the book and putting your life out there for everyone to examine, but also as a way to raise awareness and create discussion. It's really important.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on your show. I really appreciate it.
It is my pleasure. Again, everyone, today we've been speaking with our very special guest, Shenandoah Sheffalo, and she is author of Garbage Bag Suitcase, a memoir. And again, you can find out more by visiting her website, which is www.garbagebagsuitcase.com. And again, I do have a direct link to her website in the show page description. So, everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again, Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's BITERADIO.ME. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me. And our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.